From CAFE, welcome to CAFE Insider. I'm Preet Bharara.
And I'm Ann Milgram.
Happy holidays, Ann.
Happy holidays.
So this is, I guess we can call this our special extravaganza holiday special.
Edition. Yeah, it's our
May
holiday
we call
edition.
It that?
Yes.
And, holiday Insider. And what are we doing to celebrate?
Well, we have a special guest.
We have a special guest, our dear friend, Joyce Vance, who was the United States Attorney in the Northern District of Alabama. Joyce, are you there?
I am. I'm here. I'm glad to be with you guys to celebrate the extravaganza.
Do you know why we have you on in particular?
No, I don't.
We have you on because we want to see you release the Kraken.
I can release the chicken.
Will you, on the count of three, on the count of three, release the Kraken.
And the holiday episode goes downhill from here.
All right, so we have a ton of questions for Joyce.
Yes. She's
going to carry us through this episode while we sip early morning eggnog. But before we do that, I don't know, Joyce, if you're aware, we have an ongoing saga that relates to Anne's husband and his mane of hair. And people tweet and send emails, you know, what's going on with the hair? Is the hair been cut? Has it not been cut? And so I have refrained, Anne, from asking you about this because I don't want to spoil the surprise for myself.
Yeah.
What on earth is going on?
So it is a saga. As you know, he said that he would cut his hair after Biden was officially elected by the electors. And then he got a little bit cold feet, I think, because he was like, no, I meant after that day, not necessarily on that day. So we go through the weekend and I say a couple times, look, if you want me to cut your hair, which by the way, I've never done before in my life, but like, you know, I bought clippers and little hair cutting scissors back in, I think, like April or May. Just let me know. I'm here. Nothing. No response. And then Sunday afternoon, he looks at me and is like, when are you going to cut my hair? And I was like, oh. Now, meanwhile, the thing you have to do before you cut hair for the first time, you have to watch YouTube videos, like a lot of them, because I have no idea what I'm doing. So I was like, okay, give me an hour. So I go in. There's some crazy hair cutting videos on YouTube. It's crazy. And finally, I was like, you know, okay. And I did it.
You did it.
Yeah, I did it. And he just told me he just dropped our son off at school and said the people, when he was leaving, did not recognize him. He looks so different.
Good, different.
I would say, look, we've all had to learn a lot of things in the pandemic.
I would say, like, that is not a direct answer.
Here's my argument.
When
my
you
argument
begin
is,
with, I would say, look.
Well, here's the question. Are you asking when I look straight at him or when I look at him from the side or the back? Because it's sort of a different answer. Actually, I think it's pretty good.
How about for a zoom shot, like the zoom angle? How's that?
Pretty good. I have to say, I got a little into it, and then I realized, ooh, maybe I cut a little too much in a couple spots, and then you have to fix it. But like, I think it's very hard. I have a lot of respect for barbers and people who cut hair. It's not easy. And, you know, they make it sort of look easy on YouTube, and I can confirm it's not. But like, I'm ready to go again. I've already told him, like, come back to the barber shop to me in a month when you're ready.
Hey,
there is a spot I want to fix too, but yeah.
There's a spot you want to fix.
A spot or two.
I'm so relating to this because I've been cutting my husband's hair in quarantine and apparently I really suck. You. Well, I must be really bad at it because none of my boys will let me do their hair.
Oh yeah, you were telling us before
no.
we tape that you have your four children, your four grown children are with you at home.
Yes, we have our three boys. One lives around the corner, but he's here, and our daughter is home from college, so it's a full house.
And that's not including the chickens.
Chickens, 10 chickens.
Can you tell us about the chickens? People want to know about the chickens, Joyce.
So our youngest kid is a senior in high school, and he's been a really good sport about doing school from home. He hasn't been to school, doesn't see his friends. We're very cautious because we've got a kid who's immune compromised. So he just mentioned that he wanted chickens really early in all of this. And like a good mom, I went out and procured chickens. And 6 months later, we're collecting eggs and, you know, everybody goes and hangs out down by the chicken coop to drink coffee in the morning. And it's been really interesting becoming urban farmers in the middle of the city.
You know what's funny about that? My kids will say that also, but we assume it's for dinner.
I was assuming it was for eggs.
The eggs are great, but I can no longer eat chicken. I just look at chicken and I feel vaguely nauseous, like you can't eat your friends. So that hasn't been great because we don't eat a lot of meat as it is, and I've just sort of ruled out chicken.
What about chicken McNuggets?
Because they're really not chicken.
There's that great joke back when Jay Leno used to be funny that I still remember from 30 years ago. He's like, you know how little chicken there is in a McDonald's chicken McNugget? You can put it in front of an actual chicken, and the chicken will say, I see nothing here that offends me.
Joyce, do all the chickens have names?
You know, they do. They don't just have names. They have personalities. And because you can go outside and hang out with chickens, which means getting out of the house, I do that a whole lot. So the chickens are my buddies.
And your dog is okay with the chickens? I was a little worried early on about the dog-chicken relationship.
Me too. And we have three dogs, and we don't let the chickens and dogs hang out together without adult supervision. But I think that they're pretty good. And so I've been luring all of my friends into this, and my former civil chief has a couple of chickens and just is in the process of getting four more. And same deal, her dog, who's a really sweet lab, has taken to them very easily.
Do you knit for the chickens?
Preet, I haven't stooped that low yet, but if this goes on much longer, it's probably coming.
Well, because you're a great and formidable knitter, as people know. And you showcase your talents on the Twitter.
I don't know that I'm great. I'm prolific.
Prolific.
Well,
is,
it looks,
I think,
amazing.
Tantamount to great. By the way, so here, speaking of Joyce, she's here. I'm envious of you for a lot of reasons, but one is, it seems that Leslie Jones really digs you. She covers your appearances a lot. There was one last night that I tweeted about, where Leslie Jones is screaming, Joyce! and I think she describes it better than I could. And this is how you should be introduced forevermore when you're going to an event or speaking on stage. Leslie Jones says of you,
what's up, Joyce? I'm always happy to see Joyce. Joyce always got that verbiage for your ass.
I love your verbiage, Joyce.
I don't think I could be any more complimented than by that. So maybe I'll have it made into a sign and just hang it over my desk.
Yeah, or just have that be your ringtone.
But you know how we all live in hopes that our children will actually appreciate us and think that we're cool? And you would think, right, that this would have done it for me with Leslie Jones.
Saturday Night Live, yeah.
I'm still not cool. I mean, my kids, they're like, yeah, Leslie Jones is great. Mom, you're whatever.
I gotta talk to your kids.
Yeah, I think you're cool.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Last week, a couple of weeks ago, one half of Cheech and Chong started following me. My kids have no idea who that is.
I was about to say, I saw
you
that.
Were excited on Twitter.
I was very excited. Like, what is happening?
And were your kids like, who?
Yeah, they had no idea what I was talking about. No. Wait, so one thing we should announce, but we should preview, that not only is Joyce a special guest for the once-in-a-lifetime holiday extravaganza episode of the Cafe Insider podcast, but also will be a regular contributor. Is that right, Joyce?
I'm really looking forward to that. That, you know, I think we're entering this pretty interesting time, right? What comes after Trump? So I'm looking forward to getting to write about that as we move into it. Not to be serious during the extravaganza edition of the podcast, but that is something I'm looking forward to.
We should talk about some issues. So should we get into the serious stuff? But we don't have to be serious about it. And by the way, one of the reasons I can say, just right off the bat, I want to say something, right? Because all of these concerns get raised and alarm bells sound and people get worried, is there a way that Trump can, you know, steal the election either through the electors or through these lawsuits and everything else? And the answer, I assume, I can go around the horn. The answer is no. It's all going to be fine, even though there's still 30, 31 days to go. But it's going to be a little messy along the way, because Trump is desperate and the people around him are kind of pathetic, but it's going to be fine. And then we can discuss the various things that are going on. But does everyone agree that it's going to be fine?
Yeah, I agree in like the immediate next 31 days that Joe Biden will be sworn in as president. But I do think that there's lasting damage and we're going to see some crazy in the next 30 days. And so, you know, I sort of feel like, yes, I agree that the outcome will be what you say it is. But I do worry a lot about what's happening and the damage that is being done just by the fact that the president is, you know, staging or trying to stage what would be, you know, an undemocratic coup, essentially. And so I do worry about the lasting implications. But yes, I think Joe Biden will be president. Joyce?
Yeah, I agree with you completely, Anne. I think fine is sort of a relative term here. There will be a smooth or maybe a rocky transition of power. But Joe Biden will be the president come January of 2021. If we've learned anything, though, in the last 4 years, is that it's that sunlight really is the best disinfectant. And this is not the time to take our eyes off of the ball. This is the time for Americans to continue to be engaged in their democracy.
I agree with all that. So there's this crazy meeting reported on by multiple sources in the Oval Office itself, right? Attended by the President of the United States, Sidney Powell, his lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, various aides, including the White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, and I think Michael Flynn, who he pardoned some time ago. And there's a discussion about whether or not martial law could be invoked and whether or not Sidney Powell should be made a special counsel over election fraud. And there are divisions, according to the reports, with most people siding against Sidney Powell, including Rudy Giuliani. So my first question to the two of you is, when there is a fight and an argument substantively between Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell, who should win that?
First, I need to know whether this is a Saturday Night Live setup or an actual real news story, right?
Yeah. Alec Baldwin was also there.
I mean, it's just unbelievable that this is the kind of legal advice that the President of the United States is taking. And I think at some level, it's laughable and it's funny. But what it really is pathetic that when the president doesn't get or doesn't like the advice that he gets from competent people, he just replaces them with lawyers who are on the fringes. That's really who Trump is and how he should be thought about.
And it's so telling that Giuliani, even this is a step too low for him, right? And he's been a lawyer for the president and a loyalist. He's like, no, that's a crazy idea. I should also point out that there are two things. One is that it's very clear that the people in that room who did not agree with Sidney Powell and Michael Flynn basically saying, you know, you should declare martial law, you should seize the voting machines, that those folks, that people who oppose these ideas, they immediately went to the press. I mean, as you say, Preet, like this was reported in multiple news organizations. And so it was clear that they were trying to put that sunlight onto it. But the other piece that really troubled me is that it was also reported that Giuliani called the Department of Homeland Security and talked with Ken Cuccinelli, who's, you know, one of the senior leaders there, to ask if DHS could impound voting machines. And Cuccinelli rightly said, no, DHS isn't authorized to do it. But even the fact that the president has his outside lawyer calling a senior executive in the Department of Homeland Security to say, can you basically go take from states those voting machines is really, really disturbing.
And the weird thing to me is you have these people who I think have been somewhat bad actors in the past. That includes Ken Cuccinelli. That includes the White House counsel, Pat Cipollone. That includes the Attorney General, Bill Barr, who have, I think, said and done things that we have criticized and have enabled the president in various ways. And on this stuff, on the eve of the president having to leave office, you know, these are the guys who are saying, yeah, no, that thing, that's a step too far. We're not seizing any machines, no martial law. I mean, the AG, let's talk about this for a second, then talk about all of it together. We're recording this on Tuesday morning, December 22nd. I believe Bill Barr's last day is tomorrow. And in the last 2 days, he has contradicted the president on a number of things, including saying with respect to the hack that we'll talk about, it was almost certainly done by the Russians. He's not appointing a special counsel for Hunter Biden. He's not appointing a special counsel for election fraud. And there's no basis to seize these voting machines. So on his way out, he's doing and saying some of the right things. I think, Joyce, I saw you on television yesterday characterizing that in a particular way. But, you know, what do you think is going on at the end of the term when people who were so enabling of the president in many ways are now putting their foot down, at least with respect to the most recent wild requests?
You know, I have to jump in, though, and say it's pretty weak sauce, right? It's not like these people are standing up, defending democracy, expressing outrage at the thought of trying to engage the military or take, you know, voting machines into custody. It's sort of a very quiet pushback. against the president at a point in time where I think what Americans need to hear from their leaders, and particularly from these folks around the president who know better, that this isn't normal, that it's not acceptable, that it's antithetical to how our government works. So the fact that Bill Barr sort of at the 11th hour discovers that the world is round and says that is not all that impressive to me, right? I mean, it's clear that there's no rationale for appointing a special counsel when there's no conflict of interest with DOJ investigating. And look, Preet, you and I were both around. The John Edwards investigation started before the Obama Justice Department came into place. There was a Republican U.S. attorney in North Carolina who was running that investigation. He continued into the Obama investigation and took that sort of ill-fated case, you know, which ultimately didn't result in a conviction, but he carried it through to indictment and did it. And there's just no reason here to talk about a special counsel. So Bill Barr saying, well, not now, we're not there yet, is pretty weak sauce.
Yeah, it sort of falls under the category of you don't get points for doing the right thing. And this is definitely one of those examples where, but it's also such a sign of where we are in our country that I think we all felt a little relief yesterday when Barr said it. And so, you know, again, like, I think Joyce is right. Like, there's no basis for a special counsel on election fraud. There's no basis for a special counsel on Hunter Biden, right? And so I agree with all that. But I also, I did feel a little relief yesterday and a little bit, well, at least Barr is saying what we know is true, but yet some people need to hear it, I think, from him, that the president is really gone so far beyond anything that's democratic and fair. And the other point I would just make is, like, I keep going back to the fact that people are saying no, but Joyce is right. I think you're right that they're saying it quietly. But it's also like just the fact that the president is trying to do this and that people are pushing for this when, again, there's no evidence of election fraud, systemic election fraud, to then go out and have a special counsel. It's just, it's really disturbing to me that we've come so far into such a polarized universe that, like, this is the framing of the conversation that Barr has to actually go out and say no.
Yeah, look, I think it's no longer true that Trump is just trying to create a narrative. I think he's trying to create a narrative about how the election was stolen from him. But I think he's also trying to see if it's possible, hope against hope, to stay in office. And there are crazy people, and I think we can call Sidney Powell along those lines. There are people who are telling him, you can take the election back, and he's listening to them because he's hoping it may be true. And it's a measure, and I agree with everything you said, Joyce, about how it's weak sauce, but it's a measure, I think, of how crazy the newest requests and steps are that these erstwhile allies of the president are saying no. I want to drill down for a moment on one of the special counsel issues, Sidney Powell. I mean, I don't know quite what that means. Do we all agree that to be a special counsel with the powers and authorities and privileges that come with that job, like Bob Mueller had, that is an appointment made by the Attorney General pursuant to particular regulations. And if Bill Barr doesn't do it, and he said he wouldn't, and if the incoming acting Attorney General doesn't do it, Jeff Rosen, then I guess it's the case that the president could give someone, he can give someone a title if he wants, any title he wants. And if he chose to say, you know, 3 days from now, you read in the news, Sidney Powell has been appointed special counsel on election fraud, but that appointment is made by the president himself, you know, what does that mean? She wouldn't have grand jury authority. She wouldn't have, you know, other compulsory process. She wouldn't have anything. She would just be a figurehead, right? So if you read about that in a few days, should people be worried or not?
You know, it seems that she's more likely to become the White House counsel than anything else at this point. Although Rosen is sort of the wild card here, right? Yeah. We don't really know what he's inclined to do. The reality, though, you know, there's not a lot of time left on this administration. And so let's say Trump, who's so respectful of the rules, appoints her special counsel in some crazy way. I'm not sure that she has a lot of time to do anything, particularly because there would be a lot of drag from the courts, from people inside of justice, maybe right, from outside stakeholders. So we may be close enough to the finish line that it's not dangerous.
I mean, there really isn't a lot of time left. I mean, this week, I think, obviously, you know, it's a holiday week and next week as well, and people can be working, but I think a lot sort of quiets for sort of a week and a half. And then, you know, January 1st, January 4th is the first Monday back. Like, it's really just a couple weeks until Biden will be sworn in. I do wonder about Rosen, though, right? Because, you know, Bill Barr had suggested he come in as the deputy AG. He's a longtime civil lawyer. He doesn't have criminal prosecution experience. You know, he's done antitrust work. And so I wonder, you know, it's a really interesting moment. The president is going to put pressure on him, I think, like nobody's business, right? And so, like, Bill Barr says this shouldn't happen, and he's sort of setting the table. But now it's Jeff Rosen's table. And so I am curious to see where he goes with it and what he does and whether or not he stands up to the president. And I will confess, guys, I was like, is it possible the president would fire him? Like, is it possible to be fired as AG or told to step down with like 3 days left in the term? Like, you know, anything is possible. So I guess the question is, you know, how Rosen plays it and whether he's strong or whether he caves. And if he caves, whether or not he's able to turn the apparatus of the Justice Department to that effect. And I really don't think he will be able to with the amount of time left and with how, you know, the lawyers at DOJ know that there's another boss coming in. We don't know who it will be yet. But I feel like that does also change the way people in executive departments function.
I think that's right. And I remember when Rosen was first nominated and the vibe inside of DOJ, but also among alums, was how do you take a guy who's never tried a criminal case, who doesn't know anything about the criminal side of the operation, and make him the DAG? And Preet, a friend of ours who was still at Justice then, but who's no longer there, said to me, well, he has really good managerial experience managing big organizations, and that's really all that a DAG needs. So our friend was comfortable with his nomination on that basis. To me, that seems to be an important skill for the DAG, but not the reason you choose someone for that job. They have to really understand pressure, how to withstand pressure, integrity, and independence from the White House and other sorts of pressure.
I agree with that. I think it feels to me like the DAG should always be a former prosecutor, in a sense, because I think the most important thing you do is say no when you're a boss, and to know, you know, when you push forward and when you, you know, don't. And I think it's really hard if you practice civil law your whole career to then be faced by, to make those decisions with pressure from the White House, with competing demands of law enforcement and prosecutors. It's really difficult.
You know, so Bill Barr decided to leave like 27, 28 days before the end of the term, which is unusual. And you and I talked about this last week. The one thing we didn't discuss as a potential reason is that maybe Bill Barr, unlike Jeff Sessions, has some modicum of self-respect such that, you know, why keep going to work when you're being yelled at by your boss publicly and humiliated and mocked and criticized? Do you think that has something to do with it? And dare we say it, would you be more comfortable at this point, given what Bill Barr is saying, with Bill Barr staying till the end versus Jeff Rosen?
Well, things always seem to get worse with Trump, right? I mean, you think that, oh, Jeff Sessions is leaving DOJ, maybe things will get better, and then you get Matt Whitaker. Yeah. But that said, this seems rosy and optimistic, Preet, and I think I'm ready for Bill Barr to leave the Justice Department. He's done enough damage to the institution that we love for one lifetime.
Yeah, I think there's probably a reason that wasn't one of our options last week. It didn't come to the top of either of our minds.
Look, I think it's a mix of things. And one of them is, yeah, you know, if you're I remember saying this, and I said this on Stay Tuned last week. When Jeff Sessions was being criticized publicly, I asked one of the guests, I think it was Ben Wittes at the time, for how long would you continue to come to work if you were treated like that publicly by your boss? And both of our answers were, no, I would not come back to work tomorrow. So, you know, I wonder if that was part of what was going on.
I don't know. You know, the reason I question that a little bit is that I think, yes, I think Bill Barr served the president, but I also think he's had his own agenda of, you know, the power of the presidency and his own view of the world that he's executed, you know, day in and day out. And I think he's felt like, you know, the power of, I think he's wrong, but he's felt, you know, a strong level of conviction about what he thinks the Department of Justice should be and how they should lawyer for the president. And so, I don't know. I just am not so sure that's why he left. I would be more inclined to think it's because the president was really saber-rattling about firing him and that he did not want to go out fired, or that he decided he'd done everything he wanted to do. It could also be, look, I mean, I will grant this, like, it could also be that the president said, I want you to do a special counsel, or I want you to do something, and they just were at loggerheads over it. And that's the moment where Barr basically decided, like, I'm going to fight this out for the next 4 weeks.
Right. And Barr probably said, no, I won't do that thing. I will write you a sycophantic love letter masquerading as a resignation letter that we had some fun with last week. Can we talk about the other special counsel issue?
Yeah.
And Joyce, I take your point that there's not necessarily a conflict of interest at this moment. But if the Delaware U.S. attorney continues with the investigation, Joe Biden takes office. Now you have the Joe Biden Justice Department with his newly appointed attorney general overseeing, you know, the entire department, including the Delaware U.S. attorney's office, where there's an investigation of his son. Is it actually crazy for people to ask the question, should there be a special counsel in the Hunter Biden case, given the closeness to the president?
That seems to me to be an entirely different question. And I think if you're really serious about underlining the integrity and the independence of the Justice Department from the get-go, and you're the new attorney general, Preet, which would be sort of nice, you look at that situation, and I think it's going to be tough to not decide to have a special counsel, not because there is actual conflict or actual impropriety, not because the DOJ machinery can't handle the case, but just to make clear to the public that commitment to integrity and to being the opposite of everything that the Trump administration has demonstrated when it comes to how DOJ has been used to handle investigations that are close. So it may well be at that time that the next attorney general decides to appoint a special counsel.
And look, for the next attorney general, I mean, Preet and I have talked about this a little bit. This is a really difficult situation because, you know, Biden has said, and I take him at his word, that he will, whoever he selects as the attorney general, will do their job in the criminal sphere, and Biden will not interfere. But it's also the president's son. And it is distinct in some ways from the actual president being under investigation, and which sort of triggered the special counsel in the follow-up of the 2016 election. But it's still the president's son. And so there's an argument that it's also better for the attorney general to sort of, you know, farm it out to a special counsel and have it done that way, or frankly, just to, you know, put the Delaware U.S. attorney in a position where they stay, where he stays, and in some way, you know, he's responsible for this investigation and is unhindered in his ability to do that. One thing I will say on the special counsel question is that I do worry about one piece of this, which is that it can't be enough. And I'm not saying any of us are saying it, but I have heard some commentators that make it seem like, you know, one political party can't investigate a politician of another political party or someone connected to the, you know, if you're the party in office, you can't prosecute someone of your own political party. And that turns out really not to be the case. And I think just sort of from history and from my own work and from all of your work, like, look, when I was AG, the Democrats were in power. We did more political corruption cases against Democrats than Republicans because they had access to the money and the power. And that's
same
part of the
same
job.
Same in New York. Same in New York when I was the United States attorney. So I agree with all that. And to your point, the choices that the Biden administration will face include appointing a special counsel or leaving the Delaware U.S. attorney in place or elevating the Delaware U.S. attorney to the position of special counsel.
Right.
In the same way that Barr did with John Durham and others have done in the past. And people should remember another thing. You know, just because you wave a wand and say special counsel doesn't mean that that person is necessarily independent or special in any, you know, legal or reputational way, right? It depends on who it is. So if the perception is that the Delaware U.S. attorney is fairly independent, career person, and Joyce, I'm curious if you have heard anything about that gentleman. If that's the perception of him, you could see the Biden administration shooting themselves in the foot by appointing some other special counsel who's maybe not viewed as favorably or not viewed as independently. And then it looks like not a move to insulate the investigation and protect the investigation and be independent and equal before the law. But then it looks like you're replacing somebody who is doing a good job with somebody who maybe will not for the protection of the vice president's son. So I think the particulars of who you put in that position are really important. I don't know the Delaware U.S. attorney, and I think, Ann, you don't either.
I don't.
Joyce, do you have any observations?
You know, what I know is that he's career. He's been in the office for a long time. He was the first assistant to the Obama U.S. attorney. So he's, you know, this is what Ann is talking about, this notion that prosecutors have to be apolitical. Because look, by and large, everybody in this country is either going to be a Democrat or a Republican. And what the public needs to understand is what we all instinctively know, which is that prosecutors set that aside when they walk in the door. That seems a little bit naive and almost Pollyannish after we've lived through this sort of politicization of everything, including public health, that's going on in this country. But that was the reality in my office. I bet it was the reality in both of your offices. The first public corruption case I did as a U.S. attorney involved Democrats. And you follow the law and you follow the evidence and you do the right thing, and it doesn't matter who people are. We do need to restore that ethic and that sort of confidence that the public has that that's how prosecutors operate. I think it's going to be tough when the first case in the door involves the president's son. So the next attorney general will have to make some really tough, deliberate choices here.
Do you guys think, I mean, I've been thinking about this a little bit recently about DOJ generally, and we're all alums and we love the institution. I've thought a little bit about, you know, does there need to be a process, whether it's from the incoming attorney general or whether there's like the incoming attorney general creates a separate process for this of just bringing, like, as you were saying, Joyce, sunlight to sort of the ways in which the institution has been, you know, corrupted in terms of the rule of law and the places where there needs to be changes, right? Whether it's to the special counsel regs or whether it's to how Office of Legal Counsel opinions are handled. Like, I just sort of wonder, like, how public does there need to be some reckoning over the last 4 years and the institutional damage that's been done to the department? Or is it enough just to have a new attorney general who sort of, you know, turns the page and sends that message to the, you know, men and women of the department and hopefully to the country?
I actually have an essay coming in the Yale Law Journal, the online version, that argues that each of the U.S. attorneys, the 93 U.S. attorneys across the country, will need to re-engage with their communities and sort of go far above and beyond what we're used to doing, even what folks at DOJ are comfortable with doing, to help their communities understand the level of integrity and independence and the way that they operate, and really get rid of this veil that tends to cover the way we operate inside of our offices. Look, a lot of what we do, specific cases, stuff that goes in front of the grand jury, that always has to stay opaque. But we need to learn to talk more to the public about how we operate, why we do what we do, what our rules are, what our priorities are, because DOJ can't work as an entity unless the public has confidence. When DOJ makes tough calls that really are going to make half of the community angry or disappointed, it's so important that they have confidence that whether they agree with a specific call or not, they know that it was made properly.
Yeah, I so agree. I actually think this is also true of local police departments. I have this conversation a lot, which is, look, some things must be confidential because they're investigations and they're individual cases, but there are bigger issues and processes and ways that priorities are set and decisions are made that can be so much more transparent, and that it really is important for communities to see some of that. Yeah, I think it's a great suggestion.
Should we say anything more about Jeff Rosen? Or is he sort of a black box? I mean, there were some people who discussed the fact that, you know, he's somebody who looked like he weighed in on the side of Paul Manafort when he was going to go to Rikers Island. He seemed to have been one of the key figures who pushed for charges against Andy McCabe, the former deputy director of the FBI, and the grand jury reportedly didn't buy it and wouldn't agree with the indictment, the charges in the indictment. Anything else we should think about for this very short-serving next acting attorney general?
So I'll just go out on a limb here, since that seems to be what I'm doing today.
Release the Kraken.
So here's the Kraken. You know, like y'all, I've been following the Purdue Pharma cases and the issues involving opiates and how they were pushed out into communities and whether there needs to be some liability there. Rosen seems to have weighed in against some of these cases. I don't think that this full story has been told yet. In hindsight, though, I think that we will see that he was probably the wrong guy in the wrong place at the wrong time when it comes down to making communities safer and holding people who deliberately flooded some of our communities with opiates. He did not play the role a deputy attorney general should have played in getting those cases moving.
So Preet and Joyce, during the last week, we've seen a lot of attention being paid to a cyber hack of the U.S. government that looks like it's possible it began over a year ago. And the hack, at least, has been going on for months through a Texas software company called SolarWinds.
And so as we talk about the hack, we should read a listener question we got from Kathleen in Maryland, who says, "Hi, Preet and Ann. Seems as though we don't know a lot about the Russian hack of five government agencies. Do we just wait for President-elect Biden to clean up another mess? Are there repercussions for the current administration if they've really done nothing to figure it out or fix it? Thanks and happy holidays, Kathleen."
And it's now been reported that a number of government agencies were infiltrated, the State Department, the Treasury Department, the Los Alamos National Lab. I mean, it goes on and on. This is the first sort of cyber attack that I think people, other than the 2016 election, the hacking from Russia, but this one feels to me like it's different in the sense of how much public attention it has garnered. And so I think the question really is, you know, did the U.S., like, is there a problem in the United States that we were not able to defend against this? And the related question, I think, which, you know, we don't have enough information necessarily to answer yet, is really, what is the U.S. do in response to it? In part, I also think it's important to talk about because I think it is the world we live in. There's, you know, cyber hacks happening all the time. This is obviously, it's now been identified as Russia, at least publicly. Pompeo has said he believes it's Russia. Bill Barr has said he believes it's Russia.
But not the president.
But not the president.
And it's never
some 400 guy.
It's the 400-pound guy who's Chinese and is in Albania.
Yeah.
It could be that guy. Like, prove it's not.
What do you guys think of this? I mean, I feel particularly passionately about this because I think we've actually failed to sort of convey to people how much of a cyber world we live in and how important this is long term for the U.S. government to be really good at sort of fighting off these attacks and also being willing to hold other countries accountable when they engage in them. But I'd be curious to sort of hear what you think.
My quick thought on a very macro level, because we prosecuted some of the biggest cyber hacks and cyber cases in the world when I was U.S. attorney. And depending on the nature of the hack, it doesn't freak people out as much as it should. Because in a lot of these instances, you know, regular people don't see a direct impact. They don't see the harm. They don't see dead people. You know, they don't see a loss of money in their bank accounts. Now, when there are cyber hacks that result in that kind of direct loss, tangible, understandable loss, people get upset about it and they understand the gravity of it. But when, you know, millions of personnel records are hacked into and find their way into other countries' hands or into hackers' hands, it's a little bit harder. It's a little diffused. It's a little bit more difficult for people to get a handle on what was so bad about it. Here, we're talking about something that Chris Coons, by the way, using, you know, pretty bellicose language, he said, quote, "It's pretty hard to distinguish this from an act of aggression that rises to the level of an attack that qualifies as war," end quote. Well, that may be true, and that may be the right way for policy leaders and law enforcement officials and intelligence officials to think about it. But that's not necessarily something that comports with how ordinary people think of it, because they haven't seen bombs, they haven't seen any deaths, they haven't seen any casualties. So I think there's a fundamental public perception problem, even when alarm bells are being rung. And then you have the second dimension of this, which is deliberate confusion over who the rival was who caused this to happen. And you have the President of the United States, who is incapable of saying anything negative about Russia. All evidence to the contrary. I mean, here's a guy who says, based on nothing at all, that he won in a landslide, and there's overwhelming evidence of election fraud and voter fraud in the 2020 election. And yet on the other side of the coin, when there's substantial evidence from his own intelligence agencies that Russia is the author of this thing, he says, no, it could be China. And that, I think, further makes it hard for the public to fully get a handle on who the bad guy is and what to do about it. And as we've been saying throughout this program, there's not a lot of days left for Trump to do something about it. And so Joe Biden will have to act, right?
I think that's right. And I bet, like y'all, I was always taught that in these situations, your job as a law enforcement leader was to get out there fast and to make sure that everything that you said was accurate, right? You had to educate the public. They had to know what the problem was. They had to know what was going to happen. And so we're seeing Trump do everything he can do to counteract what his administration should be doing. You know, I know people love to say that it's just naming and shaming, but it's important to identify the wrongdoer, to talk about what you know, to be candid about what you don't know, and to talk about what you're going to do. And we've seen none of that from this administration. In fact, it almost leaves you with the impression that Trump just wants to dump this problem onto Biden, let it get worse by about 30 more days of inaction, and see what Biden's going to do about it. It really is very distasteful.
So one other bit of news. I'm glad we have Joyce here to talk about it with us. The ongoing saga of the census case, right? Remember, the controversy has been for a long period of time that this administration doesn't really want to count all people who live in the country. And the census, as has been understood based on the text and tradition, it's always been true that for purposes of figuring out the population, you count everyone, not just citizens, not just people with green cards, but everyone, regardless of immigration status. But this administration, the Trump administration, has made it its mission to figure out a way not to count people who are out of status. And so that fight has been going on back and forth throughout the courts for, I guess, a year and a half, 2 years now. And there was a final bid in the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court did what? Joyce, you have some involvement in the census issue?
You know, I do. There's actually a sort of a parallel case in federal court in Alabama where the state of Alabama and Congressman Mo Brooks sued the Department of Commerce to prevent them from counting people who don't have legal status in this country. And so the notion is just pretty simply this. If you count people who aren't citizens, then states like Alabama will lose seats in Congress. Those will get transferred out to states that have higher populations of undocumented people. And folks like Alabama Congressman Mo Brooks think that that's a bad idea. So I'm the local counsel in Alabama for the New York State Attorney General, who's intervened in the case along with some of the other states' attorneys generals. And it's a pretty interesting setup, right? Because if you're an originalist, if you read the Constitution and want to take it literally, the Constitution pretty clearly directs that you should count people, not citizens. And we have some confidence that the founders understood that there was a difference in the use of those two terms.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I mean, I think the precedent definitely falls very heavily in that way that we've always, and by the way, we've always counted people, including undocumented individuals as well. What's really interesting about this case to me is, and basically what the court said is, we're not going to decide it yet. And so the Commerce Department has to send a report to the president by December 31st, basically giving them the total population by states. And then the president is supposed to send a report to Congress by January 10th. And the Constitution says that report would contain the whole number of persons in each state. And so what's really interesting about this is that the president had directed Commerce essentially to give him two numbers, which is one, the number of all people, including undocumented individuals, and then the number of undocumented individuals to the extent that they could identify that with sort of taking those folks out, with the idea, again, being that you wouldn't get seats in Congress or that you'll get fewer seats in Congress if you have fewer people, and not counting undocumented workers and individuals would lead to states who have high populations of undocumented individuals not getting funding to cover those individuals. In addition to, it's not just congressional seats, it's also funding. What's really interesting about the court decision, this is a long way to say this, is that the court basically said, look, this issue, like, it's not ripe for us to decide yet. There's the case is not properly before us because Commerce hasn't yet done that, right? And we don't even know at this moment in time whether Commerce will be able to do it and how they'll do it. So basically, the court is saying, like, we don't even know whether they're going to be able to calculate the number of undocumented individuals, because remember that the court had previously said that Commerce couldn't ask that question. So they weren't able to ask people whether they were documented or undocumented. So now they're using administrative data to try to figure this out. So basically, the court says the issue isn't properly before us yet. What's really interesting to me, and I was thinking about, was the court just decided the religious freedom case in New York, where, remember, the Roman Catholic Diocese of Brooklyn and one of the synagogues had sued Governor Cuomo, basically saying that his COVID his COVID-19 health restrictions on the number of people who could be present in religious facilities, religious organizations, churches, mosques, synagogues was too restrictive and violated, you know, both the First Amendment of the Constitution and some other rights. And the court, even though that restriction wasn't in place at the time, the court struck those down. So, you know, the dissent in that case was basically saying this issue isn't properly even before us because those restrictions aren't in effect right now. So there is no deprivation of religious liberty. And then you contrast that now with this case where, you know, the court is saying, oh, the issue isn't properly before us. There's no restriction. There's no constitutional violation or other problem yet. So it just feels really inconsistent to me. And the same folks are in essentially the majority, or many of the same folks are in the majority on both cases. And so I just sort of point out the inconsistency. And I guess the bigger question is, like, obviously, if they count population by eliminating undocumented people, the case comes back to the Supreme Court. So it's really not over. And I guess the bigger question will be what the court does ultimately if the Trump administration takes that approach.
You know, I really read this opinion as an effort to not buy trouble until they have to. The court seems to be optimistic that Trump won't be able to follow through on his intentions. And in that case, they get to sidestep what they probably see as a very difficult, problematic issue for a lot of reasons.
And the court usually tries to do that when it can, so that it makes sense in that way.
So, you know, in the interest of the holidays and mirth and joy, I thought we would end this episode, special festive holiday episode, talking about a couple of cases. There's one case that came to our attention apropos of Joyce's participation, because it's from Alabama, and it has to do with the prohibition of alcohol sales. Joyce, do you want to tell us about that case?
So there's a wastewater treatment plant in Rainesville in DeKalb County, Alabama, and it came to light, don't know how, don't know why, but apparently there was a tip to police that they should go take a look at this wastewater treatment plant. They get there, and lo and behold, they find that there's a winemaking operation.
there's winemaking at the waste treatment facility.
You know, moonshine making, that's a traditional Alabama enterprise, and it's not something to be laughed at, right? Making good moonshine, or in this case, wine, can be a serious family tradition. But I guess the concern, you know, Rainesville's a small town, I think of a little bit more than 400 people. So a lot of concern about whether the same equipment that was being used to treat wastewater was being used for winemaking. There was general relief in the city when it was publicly made known that there was no overlap of equipment, that it was just convenient space, apparently.
Do you know if the facility aged the wastewater in oak barrels?
You know, we all breathed a little sigh of relief when we learned that that wasn't happening, Crete. And no oak barrels. I mean, come on. This is serious, modern, purely plastic winemaking operation.
By the way, I love that it was the supervisor of the Rainesville wastewater treatment plant who was the individual that was running this operation.
Longtime employee, apparently, with a spotless record, but no word on how good the wine was.
Would this be wine that is served in a bottle or in a box?
I think it comes to you in a little glass mason jar with a lid on top.
I see.
How do you
know
that?
Not that I've ever seen moonshine. But you know, I mean, really, this is sort of an old timey Alabama thing. And I remember there was one old moonshiner who used to get arrested every fall as the weather got to be cold, and he would come down to federal court, and Judge Allgood, one of the old judges on our bench, would put him in federal prison until it warmed up again on the other side of winter, and he would come back out. And the first year after Judge Allgood had passed away, this fella came down to court. I wasn't in the courtroom, but the story in my office went that as soon as he saw that Judge Allgood wasn't on the bench, the defendant looked up and said, "Where's Clarence?" And everybody in the courtroom cracked up because there was a relationship between law enforcement and the folks that made moonshine, maybe even to the point of drinking some of it and knowing that it came in mason jars.
Wait, you say his name was Judge Allgood?
Judge Allgood.
If I were a criminal defendant, I would like to be sentenced by Judge Allgood.
He was a fine, wonderful judge.
Joyce, do you guys make moonshine?
You don't have to answer that question.
All right, let me ask it differently.
Joyce, as your lawyer, you do not have to answer that question.
Have you ever had homemade moonshine? Have you ever tasted it?
I have tasted moonshine, yes.
I've never had it. I'm super curious.
I don't think it's a good thing. It's about as good. Before we were married, my husband took a winemaking class and made some profoundly bad wine. And I would say this is about in that same category.
Was it mixed with wastewater in any way?
You know, he was brewing it underneath the kitchen sink, so I always had my doubts.
All right, so we're not done with cases. This one I really enjoyed. So there's a gentleman, Linwood, who we don't have to talk about really, who's involved in some of these election fraud allegations. And he filed a suit, pro se, as they say, which means he is acting as his own lawyer. And he was alleging some of the same conspiracy theories as Sidney Powell, who we've been talking about, relating to Dominion and Hugo Chavez and everything else. And he filed a declaration, which is something you do in federal court, under 28 U.S.C., Section 1746, which is usually phrased in a particular way. Anne, how is it usually phrased?
It's usually standard language that says, quote, "I declare under penalty of perjury that the foregoing is true and correct." And that's language from the United States Code, Section 1746.
And people say that all the time. What did Lynn Wood say?
He said, pursuant to 28 United States Code 1746, I declare and verify under plenty of perjury.
Not penalty of perjury. Under plenty of
I'd
perjury.
I'd like a little more. I'd like plenty.
Which maybe makes that a true statement. And the question has arisen, was that a Freudian slip? Did he have a law clerk who was trying to goof on his boss? I don't know, but that's one of the all-time greats. I declare and verify under plenty of perjury. And it called to mind, and for a lot of people, and this maybe we're nerding out as lawyers, but other all-time favorite typos and gaffes in legal pleadings. Someone on Twitter talked about how signing a declaration under plenty of perjury beats the previous best legal typo, which was an appellate brief seeking to overturn a trial court decision that concluded, instead of saying the judgment below should be reversed, they left off an S and said the judgment below should be revered. And then I told you guys my own favorite, and I didn't witness this directly, but when I was a young law firm associate, there was a partner at the firm who said that he had once filed a brief that he was mortified about. There was a last minute search and replace in the brief, and so a standard term that's often used in legal briefing is the existence of a private right of action. Under certain statutes, you have that, and due to an error by a paralegal or a young associate, not me, every place it said a private right of action was changed to a private knight of action, which made it a much sexier case.
It must be mortifying to have to then go see that judge.
Because you're going to lose, because I don't think you have a right to, you have a private knight of action in any statute that I'm aware of.
You've really made the judge's day, so there's that.
Yes. So look, I know you guys think lawyers are boring, but you know, we can have a little bit of fun, at least around the holidays. So can I tell you, Joyce, we have various phrases that get used in the show and the listeners come to appreciate them. And I think some of them maybe have attached drinking games to them. Like when Anne says extraordinary, or she talks about penguins, every time Joyce is on, we can add y'all.
That's right.
We don't say y'all too much around here.
It's a great all-purpose word. Maybe I can get y'all to adopt it.
Maybe you can.
I love it.
It doesn't sound inauthentic if the Indian immigrant from New Jersey says y'all.
You know, it's just English doesn't really encompass that. So many languages do. So consider yourself sophisticated and thinking about translating from German or something else when you say y'all.
Joyce, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for enduring me, y'all. I appreciate you having me.
Now you're going overboard on the y'all. Now I think I've caused you to say it more than you might have otherwise.
It just proves that it's the perfect all-purpose word, though.
Kind of is. So it's extraordinary. Well, guys, it's true. Everyone, thank you for listening. Thanks for all your support. Have a very Merry Christmas. Have a great New Year. And we will talk to y'all in 2021.
Happy holidays. Thank you, Joyce.
Thanks very much for having me. Happy holidays.
Thanks, folks.
Take care.
That's it for this week's Cafe Insider podcast. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Anne Milgram. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior producer is Adam Waller. The technical director is David Tatasciore. And the Cafe team is Matthew Billy, David Kurlander, Sam Ozer-Staten, Noah Azulai, Nat Wiener, Jake Kaplan, Calvin Lord, Jeff Eisenman, Chris Boylan, Sean Walsh, and Margot Maley. Our music is by Andrew Dost. Thank you for being a part of the Cafe Insider community.